Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week we talked about craving, a particularly pernicious link in the chain of dependent co-arising. I ended with some examples involving acquiring a new suit and later having to guard it against cappuccino spillage. We saw how craving leads to seeking behavior, drawing in cognizance to evaluate a given situation and then plan a response. The Buddha describes such processes in terms of a particular chain of conditioning that diverges from the 12-fold chain at craving. This begins prior to feeling. Feeling gives rise to craving, as before. Craving gives rise to seeking. Seeking gives rise to gain. Gain gives rise to valuation. Valuation gives rise to fondness. Fondness gives rise to possessiveness. Possessiveness gives rise to ownership. Ownership gives rise to avarice. Avarice gives rise to guarding. And guarding gives rise to many bad, unskillful things. Starting from an initial object of craving, for instance, a successful business deal, the conscious processes of seeking will spin off an assessment and a plan. When one has been enacted, something is hopefully gained. When cognizance alights on what is gained, for instance, the suit, valuation ensues, followed by fondness, and possessiveness plays out, which is just a new instantiation of feeling gives rise to craving, gives rise to appropriation. Avarice here is craving for what we have appropriated. Notice that seeking in this chain is in response to what we crave but do not yet have, the suit, and guarding is in response to craving what we already have, the suit, at a later time. What we see in this chain is that cognizance arises anew at each step, producing growth of an assessment and plan. Among the many bad, unskillful things the Buddha mentions in this text are taking up the rod and the sword, quarrels, arguments, and fights, accusations, divisive speech, and lies. In our case, we have reached this karmic point when we pick up a chair to fend off the looming, clumsy, cappuccino-wielding gentleman that we learned about last week. An equivalent of this step is described by the Buddha with a bit more drama. And as he guards and protects his property, kings or thieves make off with it, or fire burns it, or water sweeps it away, or hateful airs make off with it. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother quarrels with son, son with mother. And here in their quarrels, brawls, and disputes, they attack each other with fists, clods, sticks, or knives, whereby they incur death or deadly suffering. Now this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering here and now, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, men take swords and shields and buckle on bows and quivers, and they charge into battle. There they are wounded by arrows and spears and splashed with boiling liquids and crushed under heavy weights, and their heads are cut off by swords, whereby they incur death or deadly suffering. Men break into houses, plunder wealth, commit burglary, ambush highways, seduce others' wives, and when they are caught, kings have many kinds of torture inflicted on them. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, people indulge in misconduct of body, speech, and mind. Having done so, on the dissolution of the body after death, they reappear in states of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. With all this fending off, quarreling, attacking, plunder, and misconduct, we've clearly wandered into the realm of ethics and karmic decision-making. Craving has a strong penchant for the unwholesome as the root of greed and aversion, as well as an encouragement for delusion. However, it is cognizance that makes karmic choices, sometimes under the influence of competing factors such as kindness or dutifulness. We'll look at cognizance and karma in our talks on the upstream links. So let's look at craving for becoming. We've been talking about craving for sensual pleasure. We saw that becoming entwines two processes, the growth of the phenomenal world, that is, our circumstances, and secondly, personality, that is, what we imprint on that world. So let's begin with personality. Craving for becoming drives the project of forging a personality. Appropriation of sensuality is where craving for sensuality and craving for becoming intersect. We appropriate things as me and mine because we crave them. We then crave what we have appropriated because that is the stuff of what we have become. All the disappointment, defensiveness, longing, and so on that craving for sensuality brings with it arises again with regard to craving for becoming. If what we have appropriated is at hand, we really have a sparkling wit, say, then we dread losing it, say through stroke or the onset of dementia, and not just for loss of sensuality, but for far worse, for loss of who we have become. A beautiful woman who in her youth turns heads, some decades later suffers distress as she sees men obliviously stare into their smartphones. If what we've appropriated is not at hand, we're not yet the tycoon that we identify with, say, then it feels like we're missing a part of who we really are, like missing an arm or a foot. Anything that challenges what is me and mine raises a loud alarm. The smallest personal insult, even the thought of theft, suspected unfaithfulness of our partner, a downturn in the stock market, criticism of our adherence to modern science or to voodoo, and we encounter such challenges with hatred and aggression. All of what we appropriate as me and mine is conditioned by craving for becoming, and much of it is at the same time conditioned by craving for sensuality. What is not based in sensuality are views and habits, our politics, our religion, our religious observances like praying or practicing mindfulness, our meticulous etiquette, our insistence on white wine with fish, our daily workout at the gym. Also outside of sensuality are the qualities that distinguish our character, sensitive and creative, spiritual but not religious, super smart, witty, a cut above the rest yet humble about it, or our politics. However, these are also craved, often with the tenacity with which we crave our car, our McMansion with wine cellar, our dog, our genuine samurai sword, or our family members. Let's look at growth. In the examples of craving for becoming so far, what we really crave is appropriation of a personality within becoming. So we might say craving becoming gives rise to appropriation, and appropriation gives rise to personality. Alongside that, we can crave growth within becoming. This is to crave experience itself, or rather, cognizance of the world. The Buddha spoke of this in terms of four nutriments for which we hunger. The four nutriments are the nutriment of edible food, second, the nutriment of contact, third, the nutriment of mental activity, and fourth, the nutriment of cognizance. The first nutriment of food provides a metaphor for the others, for just as animals are voracious consumers of physical food, the human mind is a voracious consumer of experience. Craving food, properly speaking, would be craving for sensuality rather than for becoming. But contact and mental activity are modes within the umbrella category of cognizance. Contact is experiencing objects through the senses, eyes, ears, etc., which entails cognizance. Mental activity is active cogitation of the kinds that plan, aspire, struggle, conquer, build, destroy, do, undo, invent, discover, form, transform, organize, and create. All are concomitant aspects of cognizance that feed our hunger for experience. They, like appropriation, are conditioned by craving for becoming and clearly lead to the growth of experience. So we might say, craving becoming gives rise to nutriment, and nutriment gives rise to growth. Take Quincy, for instance. Quincy loves football. He's obsessed with football, particularly with his home team, the Hedgehogs. Quincy actively seeks out ways to maximize his contact with the sport. He's bought a widescreen TV, posted the Hedgehogs' schedule on the wall, puts all else aside when the schedule demands. All of his buddies are Hedgehog fans. He has season tickets for the Hedgehogs' home games. Moreover, Quincy reads voraciously about football players, buys Hedgehogs' fan paraphernalia, and fantasizes about how he would have played the ball if he had brought his beer belly onto the field for that crucial pass. He even dreams about football under his Hedgehogs' blanket. He just cannot get enough of those Hedgehogs. Rather than simply taking interest in football as the opportunity arises, Quincy is actively feeding, foraging, hunting, doing whatever he can to quell an appetite that cannot be quelled. It is through feeding that we grow the world around the most pronounced features of our personality. As a football fan, as a ruthless business tycoon, as a bodybuilder, as a glamorous celebrity, as a drug addict, as a world leader, as the most awakened guy in the room. The growth of the phenomenal world with us right in the center kicks into high gear, giving us all the more content to appropriate as me and mine. We often prefer any kind of experiencing at all, whether pleasant or painful, to having no experience at all. This is why most people find solitude unbearable and why solitary confinement is regarded by many authorities as psychological torture. Our craving is often not so much for pleasant experiences as it is for the growth of experience itself. In fact, as we've seen, we tend to spend more time seeking than enjoying. Effectively, nutriment is parallel to appropriation in the chain, each conditioned by craving and conditioning becoming. These four kinds of nutriment have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. In view of the foregoing, this means that craving gives rise to nutriment, and nutriment gives rise to becoming, exactly parallel to craving gives rise to appropriation, and appropriation gives rise to becoming. Nutriment and appropriation play strikingly similar roles, although one is officially in the chain and the other only cross-entangled. Notice that the word for nutriment, ahara, and upadana, the word for appropriation or fuel, are also very close in meaning. Parallel conditional relations are found in the suttas. If bhikkhus, there is lust for the nutriment, edible food, if there is delight, if there is craving, cognizance becomes established there and comes to growth. There is the production of future renewed existence. This passage is repeated as for edible food, so for contact, mental activity, and for cognizance. Let's look at craving for unbecoming. Unbecoming, vibhava, the opposite of bhava, is never clearly defined by the Buddha, and its uses admit of three related interpretations that I'm aware of, and perhaps encompasses all three. Unbecoming can be annihilation of the self. Unbecoming can be achieving spiritual liberation from the self. Or unbecoming can be renunciation of some facet of personality. All three are clearly within the scope of human craving. The first way craving for unbecoming might be understood as a desire for annihilation of the self, which manifests most obviously as a suicidal impulse, or perhaps just weariness with life, but willingness to await its natural conclusion. Craving annihilation makes sense in terms of annihilationism, the view that when we die physically, that is the end, and there is no continuation of existence in any form. We discussed annihilationism in earlier talks. The second way craving for unbecoming might be understood is as a spiritual goal, for instance, in Brahmanism through merging the self with ultimate reality, or in Buddhism and other teachings through escaping the cycle of birth, suffering, and death of samsara. This last one is more upscale than the first alternative, but certainly shares some of its motivation. After all, we encourage Buddhists to recognize the tediousness of relentless suffering as we live life after life after life, always with the same basic plot, shedding mountains of bones and oceans of tears. Both alternatives would find inspiration in the following. When this self, at the breakup of the body after death, perishes and is destroyed, and does not exist after death, that is peaceful, that is exquisite, that is sufficiency. The final way craving for unbecoming might be understood is as the natural complement of becoming in the process of shaping and remaking our personality. Add a little here, shave off a little there. Personality is multifaceted, malleable, and often contains aspects we would like to outlive. We might be a ruthless business tycoon in the office, but a loving father at home, and decide to let go of one and devote ourselves to the other. We dream of being a celebrity, beautiful, famous, and wealthy, identify with that dream, and try to live up to that identity, yet at the same time we relish the anonymity of being dumpy, obscure, and impoverished. Getting married or having a religious conversion often entails sacrifice of some fundamentals. For guys, maybe drinking, womanizing, and gambling, in favor of a more domestic existence. Sometimes we even call such remakings in English rebirth. Often we reach a moment of truth in which we suddenly recognize what we have become, are repelled, or see clearly the amount of suffering for self and others it has cost, and subsequently strive to rid ourselves of that identity. This happened to Emperor Asoka. Finally, let's look at the cessation of craving. Craving is, as the origin of suffering, the link most directly implicated in the human pathology. Much of our practice is focused right here because our craving is quite responsive to practice. And as we reduce craving, we get in return instant gratification through an immediate downturn in suffering. Craving is at the same time one of the most vexing links and one of the weakest links. Although the complete cessation of suffering is difficult and requires realizing non-self in the upstream links, we can limit the grosser manifestations of craving with dedicated practice. We learn to limit craving directly through ethical practices. We've seen that craving expresses itself through seeking personal advantage, through greed and aversion. Ethical practices seek benefit for all and, when faithfully observed, override the impulse of craving. We choose virtue and replace greed and aversion with generosity and kindness. Moreover, we notice that turning toward virtue feels good. Acting out craving does not. Craving is suffering. This gives us incentive to develop further in this direction. Most of Buddhist practice develops ethic. If we scan through the Noble Eightfold Path, for instance, we discover a section blatantly concerned with virtue, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Additionally, right intention upholds the three values of renunciation, kindness, and non-harming. Right effort is largely concerned with cultivating what is wholesome in the mind and with weakening what is unwholesome. And the final three folds concern contemplative practice, useful particularly in upstream links, but also critical to ethical practice, for they shine a light into the dark corners of craving, appropriation, and becoming.